Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how much did the Electoral College matter in this presidential election? Should it be reformed? Is it anti-democratic? And if it should be reformed, just what should be done? And first, a peace agreement brokered by Russia was signed this week by Azerbaijan and Armenia to end the fighting in Artsakh, also known as the Gorno-Karabakh. What are the details of that agreement, and why did they agree? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On September 27th, 2020, fighting along the so-called line of control between Azerbaijan and the region of Nagorno-Karabakh broke out. Azerbaijani forces advanced throughout the month, and Armenian resistance struggled to hold territory. On November the 10th, the two sides agreed to a tentative peace agreement that's been brokered by Russia. This agreement has Armenians both in Armenia and throughout the world rather upset, but it appears it also stopped Azerbaijani advances against a crumbling Armenian military position. On today's show, we will explore the details of the agreement and the motivation of the parties to agree to stop the war, what it means for the region, and whether or not a more persistent peace might emerge. Our guests are Robert English, Associate Professor of International Relations at the University of Southern California. He is the author of Russia and the Idea of the West. And Richard Girigosian, the founding director of the Regional Studies Center, a think tank based in Yerevan, Armenia. He is author of Small States and the Large Costs of Regional Fracture, the Case of Armenia. Rob, we'll start with you first. What are the details of this agreement? Any specifics that you have, you know, on the agreement, and what were the motivations, you know, the parties in signing the agreement?
It's a ceasefire, a tentative peace agreement. We would love to see something more comprehensive that leads to a lasting peace, but this is a ceasefire, at least in its own right. And as all ceasefires, it halts the conflict in place. So the territory that the Azerbaijani side has occupied in the last month and a half, 6 weeks of fighting, they hold on to. Secondly, the Armenian Karabakh forces are required to cede more territory. And this is territory outside the enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh that they had essentially conquered back at the beginning of the 90s, creating a buffer or security zone around Karabakh. So that's part two. They have to give that territory back. In my rough estimate, roughly 40% of Karabakh is now back in Azerbaijani hands. And then 100% of this buffer zone, or 99%, is returned, with the exception of a small corridor that will connect Karabakh to Armenia proper. Third, there is supposed to be, or I should say third and fourth, of course, there's supposed to be exchange of bodies, of prisoners of war, of others who have been seized. And that will be also inviting in the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. So that's the only outside or multinational agency that's brought into this. And then there's also provision for opening roads. It says roads and commerce, which we don't know exactly what that means. Does that mean that the blockade of Armenia from Turkey will end, or from Azerbaijan? Or does it just mean get the roadblocks out of the rubble out of the roads in the conflict zone? But they're supposed to reopen roads and bridges and all that for commerce. It also includes two new roads, because with the change, with the advance of the Azerbaijani forces, the highway connecting Karabakh's capital, Stepanakert, to Armenia proper is now interrupted because the town of Shusha was taken by the Azerbaijanis along the way. So we'll actually have to build a new road. And this is going to be overseen by Russian peacekeepers and reinforce that. Meanwhile, another road is built in a completely different place, connecting Azerbaijan with its exclave, Nakhichevan, in a different part of Armenia. And that'll be interesting. We'll talk about that later if you like. And finally, Russian peacekeepers. There are at present 1960, I think, 1,960 personnel. I think I read from the Russian Ministry of Defense, I think 380 armored personnel carriers and another few dozen specialized pieces of equipment and vehicles. And that has a five-year mandate. So the Russians, for at least 5 years, will be patrolling and keeping the peace. And it has a provision for renewal. In fact, it's automatic renewal unless one of the parties gives 6 months' notice and says no. Those are the essentials. And the big question everyone's asking, and I'll be quiet, is what about the status of the remaining 60% or so of Karabakh, with the main population centers, with the capital of Stepanakert, that is still under Armenian control. Is that going to gain some kind of independence? Is that going to revert to some kind of administration under Azerbaijan? Is there some kind of middle ground with autonomy? We don't know yet. That is not spelled out. And that's why many say this is only a ceasefire. It's not a lasting peace.
And a quick reminder, the size of this territory is actually rather small. The Nagorno-Karabakh region, what Armenians call Artsakh, is, my understanding, is roughly about the size of the state of Delaware. So it's a pretty small area. So what Rob just described, you know, certainly seems extremely favorable to the Azerbaijanis. I can imagine this is not being received terribly well in Armenia. And of course, those are the reports. So Richard, can you tell us, how is it being received in Armenia, and what would be Armenia's motivation to agree to such an agreement?
Well, Rob did a very good job at laying out the framework where we are. Most importantly, this is nowhere near a peace deal and very much a forced ceasefire. In other words, it's much less agreement and more ceasing of firing. In other words, from an Armenian perspective, this was a Russian-crafted agreement that was virtually forced on the parties to the conflict, and especially forced on the Armenian side. From an Armenian perspective, though, I'll be honest, we had no choice. This is the best scenario for one important reason. It saved lives, stopped the fighting, and salvaged what was left of Nagorno-Karabakh. Otherwise, we were in danger and at risk of losing everyone and everything. In this context, however, there is a somewhat natural emotional outburst of frustration in Armenia directed against the government. It's not serious enough to pose a serious challenge to the government, but it is rooted in one crucial element: the government's failure to prepare society for the severity of losses that were inevitable. And unfortunately, the government did a very poor job at explaining, after 40 days and 40 nights of fighting, why and how we were losing so badly. At the same time, going forward, the conflict is in no way resolved. And we are moving to a new conflict, away from military war and combat operations into the diplomatic negotiations. This is where the so-called Minsk group, three countries within the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, has the mandate and the monopoly to diplomatically mediate. The three countries, it's Russia, the United States, and in many ways, France, sitting in the middle, in between Moscow and Washington. What the Minsk group and these three co-chairs are now trying to do is to catch up after a very unilateral diplomatic move by Russia that gives Moscow the leverage they lacked. The Nagorno-Karabakh conflict was the only conflict in the former Soviet space without a Russian military presence up until now. This changes the map as much as the military gains and losses. So basically, the real struggle is now diplomatic and is only now beginning.
Rob, I know some of the analysis for the conflict has emphasized the role that Turkey has played in an alliance with Azerbaijan. So first, is it fair to say that, you know, one of Russia's great concerns was the projection of Turkish power in the South Caucasus? And as Richard pointed out, is this Russia seeing an opportunity to be able to step in and exert an influence in a region that saw some external threats, some external pressures?
I think the answer to the first question is yes. It is a gambit, a projection of power and influence into a new region by Turkey that concerned Russia. It's so early to draw definitive conclusions about even this document, but Turkey is not part of the peacekeeping force. There are no Turkish troops in the region. Turkey will be a participant in a ceasefire monitoring group or a ceasefire consultative group that will meet regularly to discuss problems of implementation. But Turkey is not on the level of Russia in calling the shots or in actually patrolling. So Turkey got a foot in the door, but it didn't walk into the room. I guess you could use that analogy. And what I'm struck by is, you know, and it's not, it's hard to feel a sympathy for me to craft a question that says, well, poor Vladimir Putin, that anyone will sympathize with. But there are two streams of commentary out there that are incompatible, both critical of Russia. One is essentially that Russia betrayed Armenia. Russia should have acted sooner. Russia should have come more actively to Armenia's aid. What can that mean but arms and troops? The other says, now Russia is being imperialistic. Now their troops are in the South Caucasus. Well, which is it, guys? You wanted Russian troops there sooner and more dynamically earlier, or you don't want them there at all? Because Russia's being hit with both strands of criticism. So, but anyway, my job here is not to elicit sympathy for the Russian side, but really to point out the lack of clarity or the lack of conclusive thinking behind that. And let me ask this question to anybody. What would have ensued if Russia had not called a ceasefire halt and injected the 2,000 troops it has, right? This is with threat of greater force, telling Azerbaijan and Turkey it stops now. But what if they had acted a month earlier or 2 weeks earlier and simply deployed troops on Armenia's behalf? Karabakh is located in Azerbaijan. In so doing, Russia would have been literally invading Azerbaijan. And none of us, I don't mean us personally, but I mean the United States, I mean France, the other two Minsk powers, co-guarantors, as well as Russia, and anyone else for that matter, recognizes Karabakh as anything but part of Azerbaijani territory. So again, Russia, did they even have an option to do that? Or what could they have done to act earlier and save more of Karabakh? It's a really thorny question. I don't mean by this that Putin wasn't manipulating and maneuvering and waiting for the moment when he saw this was maximally advantageous. But there were no good or easy early options either, except maybe help the Armenians arm themselves better and be prepared for this onslaught of drones. And that's another whole conversation, how badly they lost on the battlefield, and they shouldn't have, in my opinion. But that's a separate strategic conversation. The complexities here are awful.
And that, by the way, is just such a tricky question with respect to peace enforcement, peacekeeping, et cetera. I mean, you know, somebody who studies the UN, the question about sovereign invitation and permission and who actually is recognized as the sovereign can always end up complicating these things. But Richard, I think part of the issue here is the relationship that Armenia has with Nagorno-Karabakh. And most Armenians, though they may state, you know, legally what Rob just said is true, Armenians view this as a part of, as a fundamental part of Armenia. How persistent is that? And then I can ask you Rob's question. Had Russia intervened earlier, how different would this have turned out?
Let me start by following Rob's thread in terms of looking at Russia first. What we see is very interesting in terms of what makes this particular resumption of hostilities, this war, different than previous rounds of fighting or conflict. Most illustratingly, most significantly, we had on the one hand an unprecedented direct Turkish engagement in support militarily of Azerbaijan's offensive, and even to the degree of operating the military-grade UAVs or drones. In addition to this unprecedented, very muscular display of military support, we had Russia uncharacteristically passive and pensive, holding back, if you will. And there are two reasons, in my opinion, analytically. One is there was a degree of complicity rooted in the very close partnership between Presidents Putin of Russia and Erdogan of Turkey, defying the West, defying NATO, in many ways, a collaboration. What's interesting, however, is the second reason. For Russian President Putin, this was a unique, effective opportunity to punish the Armenian government. After a revolution in 2018, a rare victory of nonviolent people power ushered in a new legitimate, free and fairly elected government in Armenia, this was Putin's revenge. And in effect, a reminder of the limits of Armenia's embrace and orientation to the European Union. And in this way, the end result was a win or victory for Putin with very little investment, very little cost, unlike Turkey. What Turkey leaves with is an important victory, but much less than it wanted. The victory is Turkey's regaining of its role as the military patron for Azerbaijan, replacing Russia. Russia used to be the number one arms provider to both sides, now supplier and military patron. But Turkey's very upset right now for unfulfilled expectations and diminishing route for a much more robust Turkish peacekeeping deployment with Russia. Russia has made it clear Turkey will be left with a symbolic, rather meager contribution or role overseeing the peacekeeping mandate and mission. And I do think there's friction there. Now, turning to Armenia and Nagorno-Karabakh, what makes this conflict both unique and stressfully complex to understand is this is a standalone conflict that actually erupted during the Gorbachev period of glasnost and perestroika. In other words, Nagorno-Karabakh as a conflict and as an issue predates independence for Armenia, predates Azerbaijani statehood. In other words, Nagorno-Karabakh seceded from Azerbaijan following the terms of the Soviet Constitution, ironically. And it is much harder to square the circle between territorial integrity and self-determination. This is why, for the Armenian side, there is no debate and little question that Nagorno-Karabakh will never go back to Azerbaijan. Hence the challenge. And Nagorno-Karabakh, in this context, is what I would say is the third rail of domestic politics in Armenia. No political leader of Armenia has ever stayed in power without Nagorno-Karabakh as an issue and in defense of Nagorno-Karabakh. This is an unprecedented challenge for the current government in Armenia. Fortunately, it's popular, legitimate, and democratically elected. So I am a little optimistic. But this is the quandary. This is the challenge. And finally, what's also unique, this is the only conflict and one of the few issues where Russia continues to work with the West and not against the West directly, together with France and the United States. And with the incoming Biden administration, we may see an opportunity here for post-conflict stabilization and to move to a diplomatic resolution. And finally, from an Armenian perspective, the real weakness and the danger is not only the lack of clarity in this agreement over the status, but also the fact that our security and the future of Nagorno-Karabakh and its population now rests with a small, not well-armed contingent of Russian peacekeepers. Our security is in the hands of Russian conscripts who are not very well-armed, nor mature or experienced. That's a worry in and of itself.
Rob, you know, one of the themes that Richard lays out is how much the roots of this conflict are rooted in the revolution in Armenia. And that certainly, as a democratically elected government, Nagorno-Karabakh, or Artsakh, as Armenians reference it, is such an important issue. How much is the democratization in Armenia, how much is that, you know, playing a role in this conflict? The irony being, as Armenia becomes more democratic, conflict could become all the more salient.
There are two lines of answer to that question. The first, I think, is what you are implying or suggesting, is that Putin is not happy with the democratic revolution. He's nervous about people power in states on his periphery. So he's negatively inclined towards Pashinyan and the current government, democratically elected, overthrew an authoritarian Russia-friendly regime. And so there's some measure of revenge going on here. And that I don't know. I don't think anyone knows what's in Putin's mind. I've seen convincing arguments that this is not the main thing. As long as the neighboring states are not clamoring to join NATO, to group with hostile outside powers hostile to Russia, then Russia has no problem with however they run their domestic politics, as long as it doesn't take on an overtly anti-Russian tone. Others say no, he's afraid of, you know, colored revolution spreading, so he's had it in for Pashinyan all along. I don't see strong evidence proving that he thinks either one way or the other. But there's another development aspect to democracy and foreign conflict here. And that is, it's often, and this is going to sound critical of Armenia, but it's happened again and again, that the authoritarian regime, because decisions are made by a tiny group of elites, can be capable of a more moderate and careful foreign policy. But that when you have full-blown democracy, popular passions and emotions come in, and those can actually be upsetting. What I'm referring to in this case is the following. In August of 2019, and in other statements and acts as well, but at that point, most dramatically, Pashinyan said, Karabakh is Armenian and needs to be unified with Armenia. He gave up on the delicate official position, which had been the Karabakh Armenians are deciding their own fate, right? They have seceded from Armenia. They declared independence. We support them as our kin, but we're not trying to annex them and create a super Armenia. That's their business. Pashinyan changed that with this declaration, and it infuriated the Azerbaijani side. And maybe it was just a pretext and they would have gone to war anyway. But some people point to Pashinyan and say, look, we had a decade of Khocharyan before that and Serg Sargsyan, and they were much more careful. Even though they were Karabakh Armenians, they were a little more careful with the way they framed the conflict. Because once you say Karabakh is Armenian, you're basically saying, forget the Minsk process, we're not going to compromise anymore. And that was incautious. That was a little belligerent. But it's with the spirit of a popular revolution and the desires of the Armenian people. We saw that in Georgia, right? We had a Rose Revolution, right? And Saakashvili came in and ousted the authoritarian Shevardnadze. And he immediately, I mean, democratic regimes do this to boost popularity. He immediately basically declared that we are going to take back Abkhazia, we are going to take back Ossetia, and it was much more nationalistic. That brought them nothing but bad. I actually found myself in this position at a number of public events as someone always saying caution. In 2018, at the time of the Velvet Revolution, I said, this is great, this is democratic, this is fantastic, but let's not repeat the mistakes of previous democratic revolutions that immediately embraced a little more inflammatory, a little more incautious foreign policy rhetoric that brought them grief. And I don't know what I'm saying here. I'm not in favor of autocracy or authoritarian regimes, but sometimes they are less capable of a steady and consistent foreign and security policy than are autocratic regimes. Maybe most Armenians disagree with me on that, and they think that Armenia bears none of the blame and that the Azerbaijanis were going to attack anyway. In which case, my observation is just a footnote, or maybe it's salient. I don't know.
Richard, your response?
I agree 100%. I think it was an example of impulsive, emotional leadership that defines who and what Prime Minister Pashinyan is. And I'm critical. What's interesting is the situation was even worse. It was not a policy shift. It was an off-the-cuff, unscripted remark playing to an audience without understanding the repercussions. Words are important, and a leader's words are more important. So I agree wholeheartedly. The other problem here is it demonstrates the inexperience of the democratic government in Armenia to this day. Having said that, there's an interesting other dimension here. The war between Karabakh and Azerbaijan was also an attack on an infant democracy, despite the mistakes, shortcomings, and deficiencies that we've noted. In other words, Azerbaijan, probably the worst example in terms of father to son transfer of power. It's a hereditary dynasty that has long been corrupted by oil wealth. And I do think that the fact that the Aliyev family has governed Azerbaijan for over 20 years, compared to post-revolution democratic Armenia, it's more of an Israel style, where we're exposed as a vulnerable democracy among much larger, much more powerful authoritarian governments, Turkey and Azerbaijan. This is most important because of the implications. If Armenia completely fails, if Nagorno-Karabakh is lost, this undermines Western values. Public opinion in Armenia may come to the wrong conclusion and say democracy is weak, it's vulnerable, and even our embrace of European values is overturned. And the net result is, despite the impressive nonviolence of Armenia's democratic revolution in 2018, the end of the day, it's Putin's values of submission, authoritarian leadership, rather than democracy, as the victor or an affirmation. And that's what worries me going forward. In other words, in Armenia, what I'm most worried about is the impact on reform and democracy. We are now having a democracy under threat, and reform is dangerously imperiled.
Can I, Richard, ask you a question with your long experience about something that's related to that? Because I've been working on this since the mid-80s, and I lived in Moscow from 88 to 91, and I traveled to Armenia many times. And in the 80s, there was broad sympathy among educated intellectual Russians for Armenia. And this is the time of Sumgait and the massacres and the escalating violence. And you had Andrei Sakharov, right, the conscience of the nation, the champion of human rights, spoke up unequivocally in favor of the Armenian side. And Gorbachev himself was surrounded by Armenians or Armenian Russians because they simply were among the cultural and political elite. I'm thinking of Abel Aganbegyan, right? I'm thinking of his advisor, Shakhnazarov or Shakhnazarian, and so many others. And that was simply reflexive. Right. Armenia was a tiny people with outsized cultural and intellectual achievements throughout Soviet history and Russian history before, of course. So there was no question that Russia oriented towards Armenia. And I've watched over 30 years that slowly ebb away. And under Putin, it's much more cynical, it's much more instrumental, but there's also just this passage of time and kind of mutual alienation. I never thought Armenians would be seen by so many Muscovites as just another dark-skinned people from the Caucasus, right? Hardly different from Chechens, sometimes subject to ethnic violence. Meanwhile, thinking in those terms, I am worried also when I watch the public affairs battle in the West. I have seen the money that Azerbaijan has put into putting its image forward. I can't believe when I see buses all over Washington, D.C. saying Khojaly massacre. Nobody knows what they're talking about, but they spend an enormous amount. Right. And I wonder, for me, it's reflexive. I've understood this for decades, but I wonder how many of a younger generation of American politicians have lost this sympathy and understanding of Armenians as underdogs, as admirable, and they see it like, I hate to say it, but he's on the way out, like a Trump administration. Who's got the oil? Who can do us favors? They didn't look at it that way before. And it's now become so instrumental. Who can do us favors? Who has, again, the oil, the influence, the pipelines? And Armenia has lost some of its precious asset, which was its reputation, its underdog, heroic victim of genocide status. I'm not saying the Azerbaijanis played the PR game better. I think they played it clumsily and spent a bunch of money. But somehow the passage of a generation and the salience of what the Armenians endured in the 80s and why we all sympathize with Karabakh has faded, and people see it the way I described before. Well, it's Azerbaijani territory. Armenia should compromise. What's the problem?
That's very good. Let me jump in, if I may. First, on the Russia angle, what I see when I was in Washington, I spent 10 years working in the Senate. And as a Senate staffer, meeting Yelena Bonner, Sakharov's widow, Abel was a friend, etc. What I saw was the Armenian influence in the Gorbachev period was unfortunately probably in the wrong camp. In other words, by the time Putin came, after the weakness of Yeltsin at the end, the Armenians were tied to a liberal elite in Moscow that was out of favor, Nemtsov and others. And in that way, the Armenians in Moscow never recovered after the transition from Boris Nikolaevich to Vladimir Vladimirovich. That's in the Russian context. And in the American context, especially as a Senate staffer, I agree with you. But I think the real blame is us. It's the Armenians' fault, not the Azerbaijanis trying to buy influence, but the fact that until 2018, we've had corrupt authoritarian governments ruling Armenia. That's where our influence and standing dissipated, under the governments of Robert Kocharyan and then Serge Sargsyan. It was a missed opportunity. The burden now on a democratic Armenia is to play the game a little better using soft power, where even normalization with Turkey was a step in the right direction, a statesmanship, looking forward, not being prisoner of the past only. And I am hopeful and optimistic that that will turn around, especially given the outlook for stability in Azerbaijan is tenuous at best. And I think it's very dangerous that the Azerbaijani leader is riding the tiger of war and nationalism, raising dangerously high expectations. So I do think we can recover, in other words.
One of the main themes is that with the end of the conflict, at least the ceasefire, and the likely transference of this issue becoming much more about diplomacy. And I would like to add to that, I think one of the potential triggers of this has been a relative, you know, withdrawal of the United States from within the region, an expectation that the U.S., Western Europe probably will play at least a diplomatic role in this question. This is going to be an ongoing issue, one that we're all going to need to watch, you know, pretty closely. And I want to thank both of you for providing some tremendous insights into the status of the conflict, the status of the agreement as it is right now, and a framework for us to think about and to analyze where the future diplomatic initiatives are going to go. And with that, I want to thank our guests. Our guests have been Robert English, the Associate Professor of International Relations at the University of Southern California, and the author of Russia and the Idea of the West, and Richard Garagosian, the Founding Director of the Regional Studies Center, a think tank based in Yerevan, and the author of Small States and Large Costs of Regional Fracture, The Case of Armenia. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, the Electoral College, should it be reformed? And if so, how? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The Electoral College is a holdover from the very first United States government. What is its role now in the U.S. election? Is it democratic or anti-democratic? And should it be reformed? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Last week's U.S. presidential election once again revealed fractures in the democratic principles of one person, one vote, and the practice of the Electoral College. President-elect Joe Biden has consistently led in the counting of the popular vote in this election, at this point over 5 million more votes than President Donald Trump. But the Electoral College renders the popular vote moot. Instead, winning state elections is the key to winning the presidential election. On today's show, we examine the Electoral College and the constitutional motivations behind the Electoral College, and explore whether this creates a democracy deficit in the conduction of American elections. Our guests are Sanford Levinson, the W. St. John Garwood Jr. Centennial Chair in Law at the University of Texas. He's the author of numerous books, including Fault Lines in the Constitution with Cynthia Levinson, which just recently came out in graphic novel form. And Jeremy Suri, professor in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs. He holds the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He is the author of The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. So, Professor Levinson, we'll start with you. You've written this book, Fault Lines in the Constitution. How much is the Electoral College one of those fault lines in the Constitution?
Oh, sure. I think that it takes up more pages than any other of the 20 fault lines that my wife and I identify. And I should say for a moment that the whole idea of fault lines, it's a metaphor obviously adopted from geology, the tectonic plates underneath the ground that one generally ignores until they actually come together and can wreak havoc. So our book is largely about structures. It's not particularly about rights. My own view is that we spend way too much time talking about the Constitution as a document of rights and way too little time talking about structural aspects of the Constitution. And that, as with the St. Andreas Fault, most of the time you can live your lives and simply ignore them and hope they'll go away. The Electoral College for much of the time is like that. It's just an oddball detail of the way we do things. But every now and then, and every now and then is becoming much more frequent, it really does turn out to be a menace to the American Republic. And this year is kind of one of those years, not so vivid as 2000 or 2016, or in a somewhat different way, 1968 and 1992, where the winners, that is Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton, each got to the White House with 43% of the vote. And one can make a very, very real argument that there is something wrong with a system of selecting presidents that puts in the White House somebody who is that far short of demonstrable majority support.
And Jeremy Suri, the Electoral College certainly has distortions in the democratic process in presidential elections. Is this a democracy deficit, the fact that the U.S. still uses the Electoral College?
Absolutely. And I think we could argue it's been a democracy deficit from inception. It was created in part to limit the democratic nature of our presidential elections. That's one of the original sins in our society, and it's connected, of course, to slavery. And so this process over time has led to, I think, as Sandy pointed out already, a growing separation in certain periods, including our own, between the way the popular will is registered in presidential elections and the ways in which the regional will is manifest in these elections. And it's quite striking now, aside from simply the outcomes we've seen, that you can have a state like California, for example, which gets almost no attention in presidential campaigning any longer because the Republicans realize they have no chance of winning the state, and they don't care if they lose the state by 10 million votes or by 6 million votes or by 4 million votes. So it essentially disenfranchises those voters from having influence upon the selection of a presidential candidate, whereas many of us, for a few nights in a row, we were sitting on the edge of our seats waiting for some almost unpopulated counties in Nevada to come in and for their votes. And those votes turn out to be incredibly decisive in an election like this. So it's a distortion that places territory above people. And that's a problem for a democracy.
Sandy, one of the arguments in favor of the Electoral College is it does require campaigns to pay attention to every state. That there wasn't an Electoral College, the largest states would be all the campaigns would care about. How accurate is that?
It's demonstrably false. It's a silly argument for reasons that Jeremy spelled out. Take Texas. Kamala Harris visited Texas in the last week of the campaign because the Biden campaign at that point fell under what turned out to be the delusional belief that Texas, for the first time in decades, might be in play for a Democratic candidate. But my wife and I spend our time usually, except for this semester, between Austin and Boston. In Massachusetts, one knows that there's a presidential campaign going on because the Massachusetts television market includes New Hampshire. In Texas, you would really never know there's a presidential campaign going on. So there is this truly anti-democratic, indefensible ignorance of many of the largest states of the country, New York, Illinois, Texas, and California, which almost never get campaign visits because if you're a political junkie, you really can predict how they're going to go. But it's also simply demonstrably untrue that the candidates are going to show up in most of the small states. Because if they're predictable, they don't go to Idaho, they don't go to the Dakotas. Now, in fact, they might show up in New Hampshire because New Hampshire had become something of a swing state. If Al Gore had campaigned in New Hampshire instead of Florida the last week in 2000, he would have been president. Democrats have a fixation on Florida that is difficult to justify because it's demonstrably true that Democrats don't need to carry Florida in order to win a national race. That being said, Hillary Clinton visited Florida 25 times and never bothered to return to Wisconsin after the primary there. So the Electoral College, in every conceivable way, distorts the campaign, and no reasonable person can argue that the Electoral College assures that candidates will pay attention to more than literally about 9 to 12 states. And you can measure this in terms of their allocation of spending for advertisements, on where they actually show up, where the surrogates go. So I think the argument is simply irrational.
Now, we've focused so far on geographic distortions, how often they visit states, et cetera. But I also think the way issues get framed certainly are driven by the Electoral College. One that immediately comes to mind was the importance of the issue of fracking, specifically because of its location in Pennsylvania, where everybody assumed was going to determine this election, despite the fact that there's actually not all that much fracking going on. And also, Americans are much more opposed to fracking than the handful of swing voters in Pennsylvania that might determine that. So first, Jeremy Suri, I don't know if you agree with me on that issue, and are there other issues that sort of come to mind that show that the issues that drive the election really are being driven by the Electoral College as opposed to broadly issues that reflect the general population?
Pennsylvania. Race is the overwhelming example of this. This election didn't turn on Georgia. It's a big win for Joe Biden in Georgia, but it turned on Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. These are states that have overwhelmingly white male voting populations and white female voting populations as well. But what's interesting about the white male voters is the white male voters tend to be the voters who are most resistant to a discussion of race in the election. And because they are the ones that in some ways the candidates are fighting over, you end up with a very distorted discussion of race in our election. So we had all this, I think, legitimate and important discussion about criminal justice reform during the Democratic primaries, even some of it among Republicans. There are a lot of libertarian Republicans who have concerns about the way our criminal justice system works. But all of that falls out of the presidential race because of the voters in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. If the swing states turned out to be places like Georgia and Mississippi, then you'd see a very different discussion going on, or California for that matter. So issue after issue, it's not only that the candidates trim their opinions, it's that we then get candidates who are not representative of where the public really is on these issues. The Democratic Party was smart to choose someone like Joe Biden who could demonstrably win in these swing states, But he actually was out of the mainstream in many ways of where the Democratic Party was on many of these issues. And if you had a truly national election, the Democratic Party could perhaps win on criminal justice reform, on environmental issues, in a way it can't in this system.
One of the pieces of conventional wisdom is that vice presidential candidates really don't matter. Or I think the slightly tweaked way of putting it is that vice presidential candidates historically might explain 2% of the vote, but most people really don't care. I wonder this particular year if Georgia went Democratic because of Kamala Harris, and if Pennsylvania and Michigan went Democratic because of the turnout in the big, big cities, African-American turnout. I mean, Wisconsin is very different except for Milwaukee.
And Madison.
But I don't think there's a very high percentage of African-Americans in Madison. It's like Austin, which right. in fact is basically an Anglo and Mexican-American city
right.
rather than one with a very high percentage of African-Americans. But I can imagine that the numbers crunchers might end up saying that it was Kamala Harris who won the election for Biden, and that in essence, she didn't have to make the issue of racial justice front and center other than by showing up. But as I say, to some extent, this is an empirical question. I think there's no doubt that the black vote was absolutely crucial and that more African-American voters came out this year than in 2016, where quite frankly, they didn't see much in Hillary and Tim Kaine that should mobilize them.
Right, right. The complexity, of course, Sandy, is how many voters did her presence on the ticket alienate? And one could make the argument that her presence on the ticket might have actually helped generate more Republican turnout in a state like Texas, for example.
Good. I mean, this is why I'd really love to see what some of the professionals come up with when they crunch the numbers.
Right.
Now, Sandy, since we've identified how the Electoral College can distort the elections, sort of the last big topic I want to address then is, you know, what do we do about this? Because I know there was an attempt to eliminate the Electoral College back in the late 70s, and it was defeated by yet another issue that we could certainly talk about with respect to democracy deficit, the filibuster. There's a campaign for states, a sufficient number of Electoral College votes
right.
from states that will simply designate their votes to whoever wins the popular vote. Is this the best way to approach this? Would some form of a constitutional amendment be the best way to approach this, or is this just something we're stuck with?
Well, it's a very, very good question. My friend Alex Kazar at the JFK School at Harvard published a really terrific, very scholarly book with the title, Why Do We Still Have the Electoral College? And the answer is relatively complex, and I'll try to go through it quickly, because one aspect is that the Electoral College, most people think of simply in terms that there's the possible disjunction between the popular vote and the electoral vote, which is certainly true. But the Electoral College system also includes, as a matter of practice, the winner-take-all feature of allocating the votes for every state except Maine and Nebraska. It also includes the feature that actual turnout doesn't matter so long as your side wins. So it has a vote-suppressing aspect to it. And the fourth part of the Electoral College system is the so-called contingent election system, whereby if the Electoral College doesn't agree on a majority, or if, as in 1800, there is a tie, the House of Representatives picks on a one-state, one-vote basis. Since 1816, the Electoral College has been under systematic attack. And James Madison, by the 1820s, agreed that the Electoral College was a really bad idea, in part because of the contingent election system, which we saw in all of its glory in 1824, when John Quincy Adams got to the White House, even though he had gotten fewer popular votes and fewer electoral votes than Andrew Jackson. So there was a lot of talk beginning then with getting rid of this thing. So why haven't we? Say, one answer is that it's not merely saying we want a popular vote, like, because there are all of these nested problems that big states, big battleground states, tend to like the Electoral College because they get all this unjustified attention. The ruling elites in California are delighted with the Electoral College because it means 55 sure votes for the Democrats. And why should they care if 40% of the Republicans are simply disenfranchised, in effect? In Texas, it's the same logic. And then you have, you know, the other features. But what it boils down to, according to Alex, is Article 5, that it is immensely difficult to amend the Constitution. It was actually 1969, not the 70s, is when you got a proposed amendment through the House, that is two-thirds of the House, in a cross-party coalition, said, we got to get rid of it. Richard Nixon agreed that the Electoral College was a bad idea. It failed in the Senate because of a filibuster led by two white racist supremacists, Sam Ervin, whose historical memory is that of the kindly, justice-oriented senator at the time of Watergate. But however courtly Ervin was, he was in fact a white supremacist, and he always voted against every civil rights bill, and reform of the Electoral College was viewed as the equivalent of a civil rights bill because it would break the stranglehold that white supremacists had basically over the Democratic Party. But with Strom Thurmond and the Southern strategy, they could see it happening for the Republican Party. That was the last time there was a truly serious attempt. And my own view of Article 5 is that it's probably the single worst feature of what I regard as a very defective, you mentioned fault lines. Article 5 is itself a fault line. But then there's the second thing you brought up. What about the end run around Article 5 by the so-called Fair Vote Initiative? So California, Pennsylvania, Texas, Florida all agree to give their votes to the person who comes in first. That's a wonderful solution if you are fixated on 2000 and 2016. If, on the other hand, you are bothered by 1968 and 1992, then the fair vote proposal does literally nothing to solve that problem. First of all, if I could wave a magic wand, I would get rid of the presidential system. I would ask Jeremy to get a new specialty, because I think that Max Weber was correct about 100 years ago when he suggested that presidentialism in the modern era, when you couple it with mass parties and mass media of a kind that Weber could never have imagined, that feeds Caesarism. And I think that is a real problem with the American presidency. But assuming we're stuck with a presidential system, then I would at least like the president to be able to make a more or less demonstrable claim that he or she was supported by the majority of the electorate. And the fair vote proposal really doesn't speak to that. There is a tweak on it that said, well, you could get there only if you got 45% of the vote. I don't think 45% is good enough. I want majority vote. I want a runoff, as in the state of Georgia, as in France, as in a number of other systems where you can't get to the office unless you demonstrate majority support.
It's interesting what Sandy says. I agree with it, but we do have to recognize that means Abraham Lincoln probably never would have been elected president.
Oh, yes, and Abraham Lincoln's election triggered civil war. And if you want to get rid of the Electoral College, then Lincoln might not have become president. Well, yes, that's true.
Yeah. The only thing I'd add to what Sandy said, which I think is incredibly powerful and compelling, and I agree with a lot of it, and I think much of it is built into the problems of a presidential system. And it's important for listeners to recognize that our presidential system, even though we claim it's a model for the world, it's very strange compared to any other system in the world. Until really the 1950s, one thing that leavened the problems of the Electoral College is it was at least a dynamic system. We had new states coming into the system, so it wasn't as static as it's become. One of the problems we face with the Electoral College, with our Supreme Court, with so many elements of our system, is that we've been stuck now for about half a century in a position where we're unwilling to make any change at all. And we're unwilling to make any change because we're unsatisfied with what we have, but there's no consensus on what to do about it. And I think this is the most profound Article 5 problem we have, that because it's so difficult to make these changes, right? It's not that there's a consensus to do what we're doing now. There really isn't. It's that it's very hard to form that consensus to change this. And that's how I explain, and I think this is what Alex Kasar is arguing too, that's why I explain the permanence of the Electoral College. No one likes it. It's very hard to justify in any sense, but it's very hard to organize a political coalition of sufficient number to do anything about it. That's the problem. It's a political problem. It's not an analytical problem.
Thank you both very much. We've spoken about the Electoral College and its impact on American democracy with Sanford Levinson, the W. St. John Garwood and W. St. John Garwood Jr. Centennial Chair in Law at the University of Texas, and Jeremy Suri, Professor in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs. He holds the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs at the University of Texas. That's correct. Both of our guests join us from Austin, and I thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholars Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.